We've had a great experience. We love collaborating with other firms. People normally would say we're competitors. We actually would love to collaborate with more firms because you always do learn something. We have skills and resources, maybe other people don't, but it also reciprocates. And we see that we...
Hey, this is Forrest with Concrete Conversations. Today we had a fantastic episode with Mike Tuig, the man, the myth, the mapper. Mike Tuig with DGT Engineering, and we talked about great things. What do you need to know about Mike? You need to know three things. You need to know that one, Mike is Irish. Two, Mike is a subsurface utility mappingologist. Mike, third thing, is a really experienced guy. And for those three reasons, you should watch this episode. You'll love it. Oh, fourth reason, you'll hurt my feelings if you don't. Thanks. So, Mike Tuig with DGT Associates. You've got this, there's a really common term in the industry called SU, Subsurface Utility Engineering. You have a tendency to prefer a different term. What is that term, and why do you love that term so much better?
Obviously, the industry acronym has been recognized as SUE, which is Subsurface Utility Engineering for most people. But over the years, we really don't see ourselves as engineers, even though DGT has an engineering group. Even though I, was graduated as civil engineering from college. But for me, the industry that we work in is actually mapping. So we use our remote sensing tools to locate, map, and detect what's underground. We surveyed the results, and the end product for our deliverables has always been a digital file for our customers. So in essence, we actually don't perform any engineering work. And so we have a difference of opinion in many different parties and stakeholders in our industry. But for me and the DGT team, we see subsurface utility mapping as the correct acronym for the industry we work in. Obviously, people in Australia, for example, use subsurface utility investigation, so they do SUI, and Canadians obviously prefer the SUM term as well. So there's different parties, different opinions, but I think for us, SUM is the correct term.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it's so I'm in Southern California is where I'm based out of, and in my world, being in California, the M word, mapping, that can be a very naughty term. That can be a term that can get you into some trouble, because in my world, that is a term that only a surveyor, a licensed surveyor, can actually use, because only a surveyor can create a map. So what I do, even though it'll be maybe the same thing that somebody in another part of the country or another part of the world may be doing, we just can't call it mapping, because that can run you awry of state boards and other folk. So we have to be pretty careful just about the verbiage that we use here. Is that something, because DGT, you guys do projects all over the country. Is that something that you've run into in any other parts of the country? Just the verbiage and making sure to be careful about that?
Actually, it's a great point, Forrest, because in many states, the rules change. And so you have to check with the Board of Registration for each of the disciplines you work in. So in some states, they're pretty lax, but others are quite strict on the terminology and who can work in that profession. So even I live in Florida, and even though my office is in Boston, Florida is much different from Massachusetts. And so, there's a big discrepancy between the GIS folks here in Florida and the land surveyors and what work you're allowed to do. And when you cross a threshold for, being a locator where you just put paint in the ground, but when you survey that up, or whether it's a simplistic cloud solution map, it's just maybe a sketch, and you provide that as a deliverable to your client, you may actually have crossed over a boundary in the state you're working with to upholding yourself to be a land surveyor or engineer. And so you have to check from state to state, and it is a big rule. And we think there's quite a few firms that run afoul of this. Maybe they haven't had problems with the board in their states, but it is a big concern when you work. And, obviously there's ways to work around that, and that is to team with firms in those states. Obviously, that's a big part of what goes on. But you do need to check with the Board of Licensure in the state you work in. to make sure you don't run afoul of those rules and regulations.
It is interesting how much that varies from state to state. You know, I was talking with Kent and Sean with the Geoholics recently on another episode we had with them, and they had we had a long discussion about how much variance there is for becoming a licensed surveyor, and how that, I mean, it's not a little bit different here or there. It can be vastly different from just going from one side of a state line to the other. And it's industry, or interesting in this industry that we're in of, you know, subsurface utility mapping, how little, it feels like there's so little regulation of this industry, except in a few little areas. And in these few little tranches, it's very, very important that you stay in your lane, as it were. And I've just found that to be very interesting. I wanted to see what you've seen, what your experience has been over the years of seeing these things change, because you've been in the industry for, I mean, since the 80s, I believe.
Yeah, appreciate that, Forrest. So I'm a 40-year-old rookie, in my profession. And so you always, especially when you cross state lines quite often, it is something it's always cognizant about where we work on, who's we're going to team with, and how we comply with the regulations in each state we work in. But, you know, it goes beyond just surveying up the map. Obviously, you know as well that even the tools we use can run you afoul of regulations. So GPR, for example, like we've talked about, in that it's okay in California to be locating utilities, but if soon as you say you're, mapping underground voids, you've actually crossed from one profession to another, and you could run afoul on those as well. So it is something you always have to do your paperwork on, and you just can't work everywhere and still feel that you're in compliance.
Is that something that you've seen change much over the span of your career? Or even back in the very early days?
Yeah. Not as much. I mean, if you look at many of the firms, we've often had, if you're going to be pursuing work in other states, you look to either have your own staff become licensed to work in those states, which is what DGT, a lot of our principals are all licensed in multiple states. So obviously there are core states and where we look for strategic clients. So it's always been there. I think there's just the awareness has become more available to some people, or they're aware of the necessity to abide by these rules in recent years.
Well, and so we've talked about within the United States, but maybe some of our listeners and viewers have picked up on your accent, but you're originally from the Deep South, right? From Louisiana, is that right?
I'm actually from Cork in Ireland, actually, Forrest.
What's the most interesting part about being Irish in the U.S.? Because your accent comes through for sure.
Well, actually, it's not much of a culture change, to be honest. I mean, it is different in many aspects, but when you're Irish and, you immigrate to the U.S., I mean, for me, that was back in 1985. It's like a home away from home. So we've literally been in New York and Boston and traveling the subway and found people that we've went to school with or we grew up with. So it doesn't seem that unusual, to be honest. So in fact, if you look, I mean, just the Irish culture, there's been generations of Irish people leaving, come to the U.S. So it's not difficult to assimilate into the environment here. And on the contrary, a lot of Irish people retire and go back home. So we've often always had that intrinsic link between the Irish, whether it's past or present. So it wasn't very tough. Obviously for me, I grew up in college. I went to college in Ireland, and I really enjoyed that. But what we do find in our industry, I work with a contractor, which is where my big utility background came from originally, was I worked in construction after I graduated from college. And one of the things I stood out from what I see in the culture today here in the U.S. versus my time in Ireland was that as a contractor, we were entrusted to go and find and map the underground utilities on our construction site. And we actually did that very diligently all the way back. That's 40 years ago. Today, I see contractors, and it says in the contract, they're supposed to go out and locate map utilities prior to construction. And I see almost no effort on their part, on some part. Some are very, very good, don't get me wrong. But there's other contractors that just begin work without ever doing an investigation, ever having a locator. And they just, you know, pass it off as just a chore. It's a line item, but they don't really have to abide by it. And that's where we see so many accidents. And that's why the accident numbers are not going down, because some of these laggards are still in the industry. They're still performing this, the same old practices, business as usual. And that's why some of these things fall between the cracks and we still see accidents.
Yeah. Why do you think it is that there's such a difference there in terms of, being on that side of the pond or this side, in terms of just diligence and ownership of the subsurface on your site?
Yeah, well, I think it's partly a culture. Any contractor we see that does not turn in an as-built never seems to be held accountable. Some contractors do read the letter of the contract and said, I'm required to do an as-built, I'm going to do one and turn it in. But in my experience 40 years ago, we were held accountable for finding and locating those utilities, and the engineer did verify that we had to go out and find those things, which is where the beginning of my career for locating and mapping came from. So I still have my notes from 1985 when I was out there with, you know, telecom people trying to trace out their copper lines and identify where they were and work around them. Today, and anybody that runs amok of this, they call it an accident. And there's no bigger load of BS than somebody saying there's an accident and they accidentally hit a fiber line or they accidentally hit a gas line, because there's no system. The accident is actually a failure. It's a failure to go out and do due diligence. It's a failure to locate utilities. It's a failure to vacuum. But there's no such thing as an accident. And so I dispute that term in our industry. And I think, you know, if you look at all the accidents they claim to have had over the years, there was definitely a failure on some parties or multiple parties in some instances where they just did not do the right thing. And that's why we see the industry having so many utility breaks.
Well, and just the use of that term, accident, I haven't really thought about that, but that really is kind of a, sure, there are accidents that happen on a construction site. That's kind of a given, but there is today so much that can be done to mitigate that risk that they're really just varying levels of negligence that are involved in these quote unquote accidents. And yeah, it's really, that's really just kind of mud on the face of the industry.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at some of the things, Forrest, about that, for example, if you look at, say, OSHA regulations, right? I always say when I meet and present at some of the forums and you ask people about the CFR 1956.1, and they talk about what's in those regulations. And what we have is that, you know, in those sections of OSHA, there's a thing about trench safety, that you should not be in a deep trench. Another paragraph says you shouldn't be in a confined space inside the manhole, that you just can't climb in there and just expect to have a safe environment for workers. But in between that is a whole section on utility locating, that the contractor, in addition to contacting 811 or your one call center, that they're supposed to get a pipe locator and actually do a locate to identify the presence of underground utilities that may be hazardous to a worker. And so when I talk about that OSHA regulation, no contractor has ever been able to say, oh, yeah, we know about that one. And if they only one or two people I ever did know that, it's because they had to run afoul of it and they had an incident that really caused some damage to a facility. So I think there's a need for, you know, the education awareness is still there. This is nothing new. And so having these regulations kind of be reminded that everybody plays their part in underground damage prevention. And it's not just a contractor. I think too much is placed on the contractors in many ways. So it starts with the asset owner saying we should be doing due diligence and finding utilities. The engineer said, absolutely, I should be finding utilities so that I have a good design and make the project safe. And then the contractor should be saying, yeah, you know, I've checked everything and I've cross-referenced with the underground asset owners, and we know that we've done a good job to make sure this job proceeds in a safe manner and we protect everything. But all too often, you know, we just say it's fast and the furious, and if we have a accident, we'll blame it on we couldn't have foreseen this incident. And I think that's just a horrible way to be. So I disagree with it. And something needs to change. That unfortunately requires state law, and there's only a few states have, you know, taken that initiative. Pennsylvania, obviously Colorado and Minnesota, places like that.
Yeah, you know, and to affect change, I mean, I could see this going one of two ways. That, as you stated, you could either have state or federal law come in and just make some sort of mandate, more likely state law, make some mandate concerning, you know, that starts with a thou shalt and, you know, otherwise, you know, a thou shalt or an or else. The preference, I think, would be some self-regulation, would be for us to just say in the industry, like, you know, we're just not going to do this type of thing anymore. This is just bad for business. It's bad for our industry. It's bad for our employees. It's bad for the customer. It's bad for everybody. Let's just change the way that we do business. I just don't know how you would affect that kind of change, how that would come about. It just kind of has to be regulated. It has to be mandated by the government.
Yeah, I disagree that self-change is going to happen. I'm, you know, not optimistic that people are going to do the right thing. And in fact, you know, we often write about this on LinkedIn. And, you know, it's hysterical to see some of the firms that I've known for, you know, the best part of 40 years that are well aware of surface mapping. They're well aware. They probably have an internet connection because they're giant firms in the glass towers. So I'm presume they're exposed to the internet and all the good education, the positive return of investment we get from SUM or SUE, whatever term you want to use, and see that it is something that you should do, but they actually don't do the right thing. And so you can talk about best practices all you want, unless it comes from the state legislature and says we're going to implement a law in our state, you know, Colorado, Pennsylvania, you know, Minnesota. Those states have actually taken the initiative because people haven't been doing the right thing. And what amazed me about Colorado is it was actually contractors wanted to get that law put into place, and saying that we're not going to put up with bad designs. We're not going to be blamed. You're not going to put in the specification that the contractor in the last 30 days between his bid time and his notice to proceed is actually going to be entrusted with the entire professional task of locating and mapping the underground, when that's not his business. His business is a constructor. His business is a contractor, building roads, building runways, building high-rise buildings. And then you're telling him that's his new profession, is to be in locating and mapping utilities, whereas the design engineer and the asset owner often work on a project for 2 years of design, and they said, oh, we're going to do an environmental investigation because that's critical. We're going to do a geotechnical investigation because that's critical, but you're not going to do a utility investigation. Why is that not critical? You know, this one has as much danger as any other investigation that you forsake in the early parts of a project. It has all the project overruns, and it doesn't take far from any state to find a project that has major schedule overruns and cost overruns. And look at California, in the 405 project in your area. That started with a $550 million claim for delays attributed to mostly to utilities or surprise discoveries. So trusting people to do the right thing. I guess if I was all dark hair and slim like you, Forrest, after all this gray hair and, you know, 40 years of mileage, I'm not believing that people are doing the right thing. So I'm not on board. I said, make a law, and that's the only way it's going to change. Everything else is not going to happen.
Yeah, I think it would be great if just people of their own accord did the right thing all the time, but it's just simply not really human nature to it. It's human nature, it seems like, in business, especially, that you by nature, I'm not a very pessimistic person, but it's not uncommon to find the trend in business to see what you can get away with and just see, I mean, in everything, in terms of cooking your books, in terms, and all the way down to, like, you know, skimming on the amount of rebar that you put into a foundation and not getting rebar inspections or just all sorts of things. Just anywhere that a corner can be cut, a little corner here. We open cut off too much of a corner. Inspector caught us. Next time we got to do it better. And that just seems like that's a very unfortunate trend in all business. But we're in the construction industry and that's where we see it.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, when we look at it and you still have contractors that are told to find all the utilities, I really think that's an unfair task to them when their real business is to be profitable. They can spend an inordinate amount of time going out and doing an awful lot of research and doing all the work that we do to, you know, have a comprehensive underground map of all the underground features that you're going to come across. And it's not just, you know, comparing pain from acid owners from a wall call response. You think about all the tunnels and underground spaces that we find in different cities. That's not going to be marked by paint on the ground by an acid owner. So, you know, to have a contractor be that comprehensive in the underground. Now, there is some contractors that have that skill sets, and they're very, very good at that. But that's not the norm. So if you really want to change our industry, you really have to start earlier in the design phase. We know it's already been there. The ASE gave us a standard. You know, the Federal Highway gave us all the studies and proof we want to say this is the right thing to do. Unfortunately, not everybody has got on board. And it's unfortunate, but, you know, we still have a very nice industry, but I think there's more we could do to make it better.
Absolutely. Well, everybody wants to see positive growth in the industry. Talking about change over time, I'd love to hear more about the cool pictures that you post on LinkedIn. You are known for having some amazing photographs that you have collected over the years or something. I'd love to hear a little bit more about that. We all see these cool pictures of guys in impossible working conditions. You've got your UGG Monday post that you put out every Monday. Tell us a little bit about that. I'm very interested in that.
Well, you know, see, our career started as survey and mapping. And one of the things you do is, you know, you don't get a call and just jump in a truck and drive to a site to start survey. So as our practices over the years, it's always been, you need to do your homework. So if somebody says, we've got a project 100 Main Street, and we want you to go there. Well, it doesn't make sense that you just dispatch a crew and, you know, run out there. You know, I always tell customers, they say they need me tomorrow. I say, well, I don't drive a fire truck. That's not what we do. So what we end up always have done, and we always will do, is when we have a project we're asked to look at, we want to do our homework. And in the course of doing that homework, we look at every possible source of information that could be valuable to, you know, inform ourselves and our crew what's the best scope of work, what's the appropriate technology, what's the history of the site, you know, how many changes has happened on the site since, you know, it went from green space to a brownfield site. So we need to understand what's happened on these sites. The reason I have all of those sources is because we've always done that research. And so whether, you know, back in the day, you actually physically had to go to a library, you had to go to one of the transportation agencies and dig through the archives. Over the years, it's got very easy. There's so many states have a digital archive that you just jump into and you can just do an internet search and find so much good information. And that's where all of that comes from. And every city I've worked in, you know, whether it's San Francisco has a good archive for all their streets, I found the same thing when I worked in Sydney. The city has a great archive of old pictures and files on there. And that's great information for not only locating and mapping, but what the history of the site is. You know, maybe there was contaminants, maybe there was gas tanks, what have you, because I'm predominantly an urban environment kind of guy for my projects. But these sources, I think, are often overlooked. But they're a great source of information. The photographs I post on there are just amazing because they're reminiscent of Ansel Adams. I mean, the black and white photos are classic. And it shows some of the time where the safety wasn't what it's like today for you and I on job sites.
They're just so fascinating. And some of them are just a real, I mean, they really belong on the History Channel on, you know, showcasing the history of subsurface anything, subsurface infrastructure in the U.S. And they're really riveting. Anybody who's listening or watching this should be going onto LinkedIn and following Mike Tuig there. He just has some fantastic posts, a lot of consistency in your posting, And they're either these really well posts based on a lot of experience that you can tell there's a lot of time and experience behind these posts, or just really interesting, like look at the kind of conditions these guys were working in, and sometimes both. But they're all great posts, so everybody should be following you on LinkedIn for sure. And please, everybody, follow this channel so that we can get more great guests like Mike Tuig on here.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing for us. So, you know, last week I was fortunate to take a trip back to Ireland, and I spent a few days driving the countryside and enjoying time with family. But one of my very first projects was a trenching infrastructure work. And we were trenching for a pipeline, and the contractor had a lot of old seasoned superintendents that were really rushing the project. So as a greenhorn rookie, you're the new kid on the site. Our trench got over 5 feet deep. And I, you know, said, hey, everything I know from my college, which was, you know, I had 15 minutes of experience, and said, we should have a trenching box. And the, you know, superintendent says, oh, we're going to slow it down. We can't be affording to do that. And within another day or two of trenching on that project, the trench collapsed on top of four of the workers. And so I ended up having to physically dig out the four workers. And actually, the last one I dug out was the superintendent that says we didn't need a shoring box. Luckily, they were all okay. But one of the biggest things we learned from that, if you look at those pictures, Forrest, there's an appreciation for, you know, how quickly something can go wrong in a site. And so how you can change everything by not having a best practice. So when it comes to trench safety, I mean, we all appreciate that these days. But I don't think the utility safety is as important or gets the attention that it deserves today. So today you never see, it's rare to see a trench that doesn't have a shoring box in there, even though I still find them every now and again and photograph them. But I think the thing that we spend our time on LinkedIn is to try and share those lessons learned to make sure people never forget that it just takes one mistake and you don't know what the consequences will be. So nobody really does these full risk assessments that says, listen, we didn't really compile utilities. We really don't know what's out there, but we're going to go into construction. We're going to make the contractor responsible. When you turn that around and one thing goes wrong, you do not get to control it once you have that utility strike. And so one of the articles that we like and we've often talked about happened in your neck of the woods. It was in California in 1976. It was in June. And that Culver City accident changed everything for our industry. And people forget about that this was an asset owner. In this case, it was the transportation folks. They went to construction, said, we're going to do the same thing that people are doing today, where they put it into the contractor, said, well, we haven't located all the utilities, but we're going to make the contractor responsible for this work. Well, the contractor went to work, and he didn't have the time to do it. So he didn't go and map the two gasoline lines running through the street. And when they struck the lines, it spewed raw gasoline over the streets. It rained down raindrops of gasoline, which exploded. And that explosion killed people instantly. They were incinerated. So you have that one fleeting moment where one mistake by one person can actually have a catastrophic event. And the risk assessment is just not there by these big design firms today. The owners believe they're in good hands with design firms. The firms are, a lot of them are skipping over this task to do this investigation in the design phase to make sure nobody will break a gas line like that. So here we are, decades later, five decades later, we're still making the same mistake. So it's inexcusable, and I'm not looking for votes, and I don't care if anybody likes me or not, but we have to keep on pushing the rhetoric to say you're doing the wrong thing. You need to do the right thing. There's a lot of great people like you around the country that are learning and getting better and better every day at what we do. So it's inexcusable you can't find a vendor to help you get those drawings to perfection so that we can make sure we stop accidents in the future.
Have you had success in changing minds around this that didn't involve an accident? I'm sure your superintendent, when you were a greenhorn, changed his mind on having a box in the trench there after you had to dig him out by hand. But have you had success in changing minds on this topic of safety concerning subsurface utilities that didn't involve a Culver City explosion or a superintendent buried up to his neck?
Well, I think if you look at some of our clients these days, a younger generation are a lot more digital savvy. They're able to take the information out on site, and they see the value of the work that we do in terms of that. If you look at the information we have, they said, hey, you know, we don't have any plans and records. We've hired you. You've gone out and located, mapped the underground. We now have a very reliable documents that we can use for not only operation and management, where you can use it in design and construction. And so there's a fantastic ROI. So I think, to answer your question, yes, we have found lots of success, but it's with strategic clients that are like-minded, which means that we are happy to travel around the country to work with a client that appreciates our work, and I'm happy to drive by a customer who doesn't value the work that we do and that they're still going to do the same thing. So there's many people that I've known for years and years. They're still going to do the same thing. They're never going to map the underground. They're going to take their chances. They're going to rely on the one call as the only thing. And it's very short-sighted on them to not change over when they know there's a return on investment. Unfortunately, the culture doesn't change unless they have an accident. And, you know, you have to look at the 2004 accident in Walnut Creek, where you said experienced people, everybody on that team in Walnut Creek in 2004 actually had experience with underground locating and mapping, but they all forsake the underground locate work. And as a result, they had another catastrophic accident that claimed seven lives. And many of these firms don't make it through these. When they do have an accident like that, hundreds of millions of dollars change hands. The firm goes out of business, but the culture keeps on going for many, many firms to do the same old thing, even though they know there's not a positive result.
You know, and you talk about DGT, how you guys will travel around the country to work with specific firms who appreciate your work, who appreciate your level of accuracy, your level of deliverable, and also that you guys just don't compromise on some things. And I was having a conversation with Matt Bird. He's with the Reality Capture Network, big guy in laser scanning, and really great guy. And we were talking about projects that both he and I had done very early on in our career, when we accepted jobs or did things that paid us a check, because we were just so hungry, we just kind of turned a blind eye to the safety concerns or to the things that were being asked of us. And as I've been progressing through my career, I'm seeing more and more that there are just things that I'm just not willing to do. And he had said the same thing. He was crawling through this old mine and that hadn't been updated in many, many decades, and seemed like it was falling apart. No cell service, pretty sketchy, no supplemental oxygen. And he said, if I got offered that today, I'd turn it down fast. And it's a nice situation to be where you are, where you have the reputation, you have the, frankly, the cash flow in the very beginning, when it's just you, yourself, and nobody else. You're hungry and you just need to be able to pay some bills. And so you do things that are a little more sketchy. And in hindsight, you wonder if it was worth that risk. But that's the kind of thing, I suppose, that perpetuates just some bad habits in the industry.
But, I think everybody, has done something that they shouldn't have done, or they made poor judgments when they look back in retrospect. But I think everybody's guilty of that. I think as you go through, many of us were very fortunate, especially all the principals at DGT, we were very fortunate that when we started our careers, we had some great mentors and trainers, and they gave us, so we got our education in college. But when we went to work, we really got got some great training and mentoring from senior members that wanted to pass down what you should and shouldn't do. So we were fortunate, and that's why we are so adamant about doing all our LinkedIn posts and sharing the knowledge, the lessons learned. But I think these days, I think people have more access to information, so I think it's easier to get what you should and shouldn't do. You're able to jump on most places. An internet search will say what's right or wrong. You should be able to get some information. So these days, I think you've less excuses to do something that's just not right. Unfortunately, I think everybody's done it. Somebody says they've never done it, they're lying to you. We all know that. But there are still things in our industry that I'm concerned about. If you look at, there's not a single time I haven't been around job sites where I see a lot of locators, whether they're one call guys or asset owners or private contract locators, and we're out on the streets without full traffic control. That's a concern because we get target. If you ever rode a motorcycle, you know that one of the rules is target fixation. If you see something, you're just going to, you know, keep looking at it. You're going to hit it. So they teach you very quickly, you know, to avoid these accidents. But if you look at some of these locators, they're fixated on their device and they're looking at the screen, whether it's a GPR or a pipe locator, and they're unaware of traffic. There's definitely a lapse in your judgment and traffic sneaks up on you. And there's all too often we can have an accident out there where it shouldn't have been. And other countries don't allow that. But in the U.S., we all kind of turn a blind eye to working in traffic without full traffic control, and it is a concern. So there's things still out there in our industry that we need to fix as well, not just the laws about SUM and SUE, but the way we do work as practitioners, how we do our work better and be safer.
You know, you've brought up LinkedIn a number of times, and LinkedIn is a very, very new, new in the world here. And it's facilitated a lot of networking. I use LinkedIn quite a lot. You're very, very frequently on there, but you're also just extremely well connected. And I would assume that that was something that predated LinkedIn. What was networking like for you, and how did you capitalize on the building of a network before social media networks came out and created that?
Well, you know, for many of us, we've been involved with trade shows all of our career, whether it's just going there for networking, which is really how most of my organic growth of all the people I know in the industry happened. But I think it was great because you get educational, like the Excavation Safety Conference this week. Unfortunately, I won't be able to attend in this one. But, you know, that's been one of the fantastic conferences for us to meet everybody, whether it's the hardware people, the software people, the scientists behind some of the systems. They've been great things to attend, and that's where it all started before LinkedIn. These days, I still think we probably, you know, meeting and greet in person is still much stronger than a LinkedIn connection. But, you know, it does help the growth, and it helps you connect with the right people for the right industry and even the tools and the training that you need to be a better professional.
Yeah, the LinkedIn has been extremely helpful for me, both in terms of professional development and in getting more work. But it's really been for me just kind of a primer for those trade shows, for those in-person events like Excavation Safety Conference, which was the first place where you and I met in person. Actually, the first time you may not remember this, the first time that you and I had any interactions was before I started my own company. But I had seen you posting these really interesting historical photos on LinkedIn, and I started following you. And this was maybe 7 or 8 years ago or so. And I was giving a presentation at a university about subsurface utility mapping, and I asked you permission to be able to share one of your photos, and you said, "Yeah, sure, that's fine. Don't worry about it. And, you know, if anybody asks where you got it, just tell them you got it from me." But you're just very, very kind in to me, just a kid, and I was in my early 30s and very, very new in the industry. And you're quite magnanimous, just in letting me kind of, you know, ride your coattails a little bit in terms of sharing some impressive content with this group of university students. And anyway, fond memory for me in my first interaction with you.
Yeah, I appreciate that. But, you know, we do that constantly. I think it's not about self-promotion, you know, for us, Forrest. We have to get the message out. We have to share the lessons, what, you know, does work well as what doesn't work well. You know, obviously for me, starting in a trench in a utility incident, you know, again, you can see these things happen. You can talk about it all you want, but unless you've actually experienced that and said, how does this happen? you know, and how do you prevent it? So we want to share as much as we can with as many other industry like-minded people. And that's what turns the tide in our industries, to have, you know, better competitors in our industry, better people all, you know, preaching the right thing and doing the right thing in the work. And then obviously we don't want laggards in our industry, because if we have laggards, they're going to be obviously you're cutting on costs on safety and training and everything else. So you're going to be more competitive. So customers do pick the cheapest guy in many instances. And if we don't weed those people out, then they're going to continue to be there. So for us, it's behoove us to share as much as we can. To have more people like you grow a company and say, we're going to do the right thing, we're going to get the training, and we're going to be a really good competitor in the industry. So, and we appreciate that.
Well, thanks, Mike. It's been I've grown considerably through our professional relationship here, and through LinkedIn and seeing each other at trade shows and just developing a friendship, and our companies being able to work together on a couple of projects. And that's been really, eye-opening, just how much we've been able to learn from you and from your team on those projects. So I've appreciated that a lot, and just appreciate you being on our podcast today. Everybody should definitely go out and follow Mike Tuig on LinkedIn. Like I said, a lot of valuable content there. Just a rich encyclopedic knowledge of the history and the present day circumstances of the subsurface utility mapping environment. And Mike, thanks so much for being on today. Really appreciate you professionally, appreciate you as a friend.
Absolutely. And just to close on that, Forrest, you know, one of the things, you know, when I always say I'm a 40-year rookie in this industry, the one thing I've learned from all the years and all the continents I've worked on is that I can learn from everybody. So just because you've had enough of mileage doesn't mean you know what the best way to do it, that there isn't a better trick, there isn't, you know, things that you can learn. And every time, whether it's working with you or Dave and some of your fantastic team, we've had a great experience, and we love collaborating with other firms. People that normally would say we're competitors, we actually would love to collaborate with more firms, because you always do learn something. We have skills and resources, maybe other people don't, but it also reciprocates. And we see that we working with other people, we learn, we're a better firm, we do a better product for our client. And in many cases, we're even more competitive in pricing because we share the work across the country, you know? So we appreciate the opportunity to work with you as well and to share the knowledge.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Thank you for having us on there today.
Thanks very much, Mike.